Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 6. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 33. We will look at Elisha's floating axe head, and we will see Ben-Hadad besieging Samaria, and Elisha's servant seeing the city surrounded by chariots of fire and horsemen. So we start now in 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. Now the sons of the prophet said to Elisha, and let me say that Elisha prophesied during the time of Joram. King Joram of the northern kingdom of Israel was the second son of Ahab. Joram ruled from 852 to 841. Elijah prophesied in the reign of Ahab, who's Joram's father. Ahab ruled from 874 to 853. And Elijah also prophesied in the time of Ahaziah, Ahab's first son. That was 853 to 852. So that gives you a feel for where we are now. Elisha and Joram, if you just remember that prophet and that king, that helps you orient yourself in time. And Joram, again, is 852 to 841. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "Behold now, the place before you where we are living is too limited for us. Please let us go to the Jordan, and each of us take from there a beam, and let us make a place there for ourselves where we may live." So he said, "Go." Then one said, "Please be willing to go with your servants." And he answered, "I shall go." So he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water, and he cried out and said, "Alas, my master, for it was borrowed." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" And when he showed him the place, he, that's Elisha, cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. He, Elisha, said, "Take it up for yourself." So he, the axeless prophet, put out his hand and took it. Now, where did this happen? Where did verse 1 happen when the prophet said, we need to move? We don't have enough room here. That was probably at Gilgal, which is the Gilgal between Shechem to the north and Bethel to the south. There are about 4 Gilgals on the map, and they all have question marks, but we'll assume that this is where we are. John Gill says it's that Gilgal. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says it's either Bethel or Jericho is where they were when this happened, which just proves that nobody really knows where this took place. But wherever it was, the house was too small, or the place where they were living was too small for us, and so they wanted to build more houses. The place we were living is too limited, it says. Now, why was it too limited? Probably because the prophet's number had grown because of Elisha's remarkable influence. This guy Elisha was something else. He did all sorts of miracles. He had all kinds of prophecies. And I'm sure that people were attracted to that. And so the number of the schools of the prophets got larger and larger. The prophets say that the numbers of the prophets increased because Gehazi, Elisha's crooked attendant, crooked servant who tried to rob the Syrian general Naaman of money. As you recall, we just went over that. Gehazi got leprosy for his trouble. That was the last chapter. And so we assume that Gehazi is no longer working for Elisha. He's gone. And the rabbis say, "Well, he's gone now. That's why people are coming." Now, I think that's just rabbinic folklore. It's probably just because people wanted to follow Elisha. This is despite the overall spiritual degeneracy of northern Israel. Most people are worshiping those golden calves at Dan and Bethel. So Elisha follows his prophets on down to the Jordan River. If you look at my BibleAtlas.org map, you'll see Gilgal, the one between Shechem and Bethel. If you go from that Gilgal, which again has a question mark, so this is an estimate, you go about 15 miles, you hit the Jordan River, which was heavily wooded on its banks. The prophets were cutting down trees, because each prophet was going to take one beam from a tree and carry it back to wherever they were going to live, either Jericho or Gilgal or Bethel or wherever they were going to build their house. Now notice that these prophets were not super spiritual prophets. They didn't just sit around navel-gazing all day long and giving prophecies about world events. They actually knew how to cut timber down and build a house. Building houses is complicated. My father used to do it for a living, and I helped him build this house that I'm living in, and I'm telling you, I'll never do it again. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not something that pie-eyed prophets you would think would get into. But these prophets could do it. So that's a little word of warning there. You see these super spiritual types that can prophesy at the drop of a hat. If they can't balance a budget or manage a family, stay away from them. Now, why did the prophets in verse 3 want Elisha to follow them to the Jordan River? Here's some possibilities. Maybe they wanted Elisha to preserve peace and order among the prophets. I don't think so. I don't think prophets are that poorly managed that they have to have a supervisor to go with them. Some people have speculated that perhaps the prophets wanted Elisha's advice on how and where to build the house they were going to build. That's reasonable. Some say they wanted to be protected by Elisha's supernatural power from men or wild beasts. I don't know why they would be particularly afraid of wild beasts or men. I mean, everybody in Israel had to deal with that. But now, maybe men might want to attack them because they were prophets, and prophets make people angry, especially if they're involved with the government of Joram. So that might be a reasonable reason, too. But for whatever reason, they go on down to the Jordan River with Elisha. They use the trees to bring back the beams made out of the trees. That would be for the floor and the rafters. The walls would be built of stone, as John Gill says. So in the process of this tree cutting, one of the axe heads flies off the axe and plops into the Jordan River. The owner of the axe, or I should say the borrower of the axe, was all upset. He says, alas, he was poor, as all prophets were. And so losing that axe head was a big deal to him, especially since he had borrowed the axe and he would have to replace it. And he's poor. Compare his poverty with the prophets that we have in modern day America in their fancy church auditoriums with the flashing strobe lights, the monstrous stages, the monstrous PowerPoint presentations on the monstrous screens as they prophesy that Trump won the election, as Joe Biden swears the oath of allegiance. Well, these prophets were real prophets, and they were poor, and Elisha is concerned enough to raise that axe head. Now, Ellicott, the commentator, says that recovering the axe head shows that God cares about the details of his people's lives. And I think that's a good application there. Of course, that's not really a small detail. That man was poor and had to give that axe back, and axes, I'm sure, were valuable back then. I guess the axe head was made out of iron. I'm not exactly sure how prevalent iron axe heads were, how easy they were to make, or how expensive they were, but I'm sure it was a lot for this prophet. But still, God cares about your daily affairs if your tools break. Now in verse 6, Elisha says, where did the axe fall into the water? And the borrower of the axe showed Elisha where the axe had fallen into the water. Now notice that Elisha was not omniscient. No prophet was ever omniscient. They always saw through a glass darkly until, boom, there was a beam of light from heaven to illuminate a certain point. But no prophet knew everything, and they had to pray like everybody else. So Elisha doesn't know where the axe is except through natural means. He sees it, and then he throws a stick at the place where the axe head had sunk. Now, why did he do that? I'm going to give you six options. First option, the stick had the power to draw the iron up. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, how's a stick going to draw an iron axe head out of the water? Unless it was a stick that somehow had Elisha's power miraculously infused into it, which I don't believe for a second. So we can scratch option number one. Option number two, the stick was thrown into the water in order to fall into the handle hole of the axe head at the bottom of the Jordan. Well, what are the odds of that? About 5 trillion to 1. And if they were near Jericho, which is one possibility, the Jordan is deep and rapid there. But even if the Jordan is not deep and rapid there, that's a nonsensical option. Although some people have suggested that the handle falls into the hole of the iron. Well, I guess that would be miraculous. That would be just as miraculous as the iron just floating to the top. Well, I don't think that's it. Option number three, Elisha stuck the stick in the water to stick it into the handle hole of the axe head. Now, here's a rationalist answer. Elisha just took the handle, stuck it down in the water, found the axe head at the bottom because the water's clear where he can see. That's an assumption. And then he sticks the stick into the head of the axe and he brings it up. The Cambridge commentary and Colin Delitzsch deny that. Colin Delitzsch says this option needs no refutation. A stick is not going to make an axe head float. Verse 6 says that the iron floated. It didn't say it was brought up. It says it floated. So option number 3 is not going to fly. Option number four, Elisha passed the piece of wood underneath the axe head. He sees it lying at the bottom of the Jordan, and then he just sticks the stick under the axe head and brings the axe head up. Well, that's not reasonable, as the pulpit commentator says. Why would the author of 2 Kings even bother to record such a mundane event? Big deal. Axe head falls in the water during construction. We lift it up with a stick. Woo! Praise God. Hallelujah. Let's have a feast. That's absurd. So option number four is not going to fly. Option number five, as to why Elisha threw the stick in the water. Adam Clark says it was a ceremonial action. I don't know what's ceremonial about throwing a stick into the water. Doesn't seem very august to me. It doesn't give me any hallelujah goosebumps. That's not a reasonable option in my humble opinion. So let's go to option number six. This is from the commentator Benson, the Methodist. He says this: the stick was thrown into the water to direct attention to the spot where the miracle was to occur, so all the prophets would be able to see it. And I think that makes a lot of sense, and that's the one I'm going to go with. So we now go to 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 8 through 10. Now the king of Aram was warring against Israel, and he counseled with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." The man of God sent word to the king, that's Elisha, sent word to the king of Israel, that's Joram. So Elisha sends word to Joram, saying, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Arameans are coming down there." Remember, the Arameans are the Syrians, northeast of Israel. The king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, so that he guarded himself more than once or twice. Now the king of Aram, as I said earlier, is Ben-Hadad II, who ruled between 860 and 841. He's in a war with Joram, who ruled between 852 and 841. So this battle is somewhere between 852 and 841, but nobody knows what war it is. It's not cited anywhere else. The cause of the war is also not known, so we don't have to worry about that. I said it's Joram. Kylan Delitzsch says it's Joram. All the other commentators just punt. They don't say. They just call him the king of Israel. No, we're going to call him Joram because I believe that's who it was. Now in verse 8, Ben-Hadad II is saying, "Such and such a place shall be my camp." What he means is, such and such a place shall be an ambush, so we can knock off some Israelites. And of course, Elisha would then go tell Joram, "Don't go there, it's an ambush there." And then Joram would go to the place that Elisha had warned him about, and lo and behold, there would the Syrians be, but Joram's troops wouldn't be there. And so then Joram would know that Elisha was accurately predicting where the Syrian ambushes would be. Now, some people say the king didn't really respect Elisha, and that's why he went to check him out to see whether Elisha was true or not. I don't believe that. It's only natural, in my opinion, to see if the prophecy was accurate, and I doubt very seriously that Elisha cared whether Joram checked him out or not. He's probably saying, "Yeah, go down there, Joram. You'll see that I know how to prophesy." Now, of course, this was supernatural prophecy. Elisha had no way of knowing where Ben-Hadad II was going to put his troops, as Adam Clark says. Clark also says that perhaps Joram didn't just go down to check out the place, but he actually went and put troops in the place to preempt the Syrians from coming in and occupying the place. And of course, that would let the Syrians know that the Israelites were wise to them. I suspect the Syrians would know that the Israelites were wise to them, even if Joram didn't bring troops to the place. The king of Israel, the king of Aram, Ben-Hadad II, would think, "Well, why do, whenever we set an ambush, the troops of Israel never show up?" Either way, he's suspicious. We go down to 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 11 through 14. Now the heart of the king of Aram was enraged over this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, "Will you tell me which of us is for the king of Israel?" One of his servants said, "No, my lord, O king. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." So he, that's Ben-Hadad II, said, "Go and see where Elisha is, that I may send and take him." And it was told him, told Ben-Hadad II, saying, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So Ben-Hadad II sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night. The army came by night and surrounded the city. Now the attendant said that Elisha could know what Ben-Hadad II was saying in his bedroom. That's somewhat of an exaggeration, but he got the point across. So there's only one thing for Ben-Hadad II to do is go find Elisha and kill him so he can't prophesy against him anymore. He now realizes that none of his counselors have been unfaithful to him. In fact, he suspected that at first, because in verse 11, he called his servants and tell me, he says, which of us is for the king of Israel? Which of us is selling out military secrets to Joram? An embarrassing meeting, and one of his counselors, one of his courtiers said, it's the prophet that's doing this. Now, Ben-Hadad II must have had a great respect for Elisha's abilities to believe this, because the natural thing to believe would be that one of his own people is betraying his secrets. Well, Ben-Hadad II had probably heard about Elisha healing Naaman, for example. Elisha's prophecies had probably gotten around even to Syria. At least that one did, because Naaman was Ben-Hadad II's general. So suspicion is removed from his own people, and he then proceeds to go arrest Elisha. So Elisha can no longer reveal his military secrets, Ben-Hadad II's military secrets, to Joram. Now, Elisha at this time is in Dothan. I don't know how the Syrians knew that. Dothan is about 10 miles southwest of Jezreel, where the kings of northern Israel had their summer place. And Jezreel, of course, is at the south end of the Jezreel Valley, or the Valley of Esdraelon. Dothan is about 10 miles to the southwest of Mount Gilboa, where Saul and Jonathan were killed in their last battle, and it's north of Shechem. It's a well-known place. It's a city in the tribe of Manasseh. It's not far from Shechem, as Gil says. Easton says the name Dothan means two wells. Now, Dothan is famous because this is where Joseph went looking for his 12 brothers, if you will recall that story. So Easton says this, Dothan means two wells, a famous pasture ground where Joseph found his brethren watching their flocks. Here, at the suggestion of Judah, they sold him to the Ishmaelite merchants. It is mentioned on monuments in B.C. 1600. I assume that's Egyptian monuments. It was the residence of Elisha and the scene of a remarkable vision of chariots and horses of fire surrounding the mountain on which the city stood, which we're going to read about in just a minute. It's on the south side of the plain of Jezreel, as I've just said, by 12 miles north of Samaria, among the hills of Gilboa. Easton's writing in the 19th century says the two wells, remember Dothan means two wells, the two wells are still in existence, one of which bears the name of the Pit of Joseph. Very interesting. So Ben-Hadad II's army came by night. Well, that's, of course, for the purpose of surprise, to keep the people of Dothan from getting help from Samaria further to the southwest. It wasn't too far off, Samaria was, so they needed to catch Elisha by surprise. They surround the city to cut off Elisha's escape. Now, it's interesting. Ben-Hadad II respected Elisha's ability to supernaturally protect the king of Israel from ambush, but he somehow thought that Elisha wouldn't be able to protect Elisha's own life from ambush. Well, he's a king. He's got an army. He's going to go get him. 2 Kings 6, verses 15 through 17. Now, when the attendant of the man of God, that's Elisha, had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant, Elisha's servant, said to Elisha, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" So Elisha answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Verse 15, this attendant who saw this vision was not Gehazi. He had leprosy for trying to snooker Naaman the Syrian after Elisha had healed Naaman. So we have a new servant. And, of course, I'm assuming this event happened after the healing of Naaman. It's at least afterwards in the book of Kings. So that's a reasonable assumption, I think. So a new attendant, he looks out either from the door of Elisha's house or maybe he went to the gates of the city and looked out of the gates. He says, "Oh, my goodness, we are surrounded by bad guys. What are we going to do?" he asked Elisha. Now, the servant might be thinking, maybe the Syrians are after the town of Dothan, but maybe they're after Elisha personally. Maybe he's thinking, "Elisha, maybe you ought to give yourself up so that the city of Dothan doesn't have to undergo a siege." I don't know what he was thinking. But if he's thinking that the Syrians are coming after his master personally, then his concern would be greater because I'm sure he loved his master, and plus he would be at more danger to himself. If he's a mere citizen of Dothan, that would be dangerous. But if you are the servant of the man that they're coming after, it's even worse. And that's, of course, exactly what was going on here. Elisha has to buck up the servant and says, "Do not fear. We got more of ours than they've got of theirs," meaning supernatural forces. He had to tell a servant not to fear, probably because the new servant would not have had much firsthand experience with Elisha's powers because he's new. Now it says in verse 17, when the servant opened his eyes, he saw that the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire. What mountain? Well, it could be the mountain on which Dothan was built, and so there were horses of chariots and fire all around the servant, because the fiery chariot and the horses of fire would be all around the mountain that Dothan was on. Or it could be another mountain near Dothan. I suspect the latter option is true. The horses and chariots were on another mountain. Now, they were horses and chariots of fire. Fire is powerful. It's devouring. As Ellicott says, it's a symbol of Yahweh's physical presence. Fire generally means that, and so that's not a problem as to what it means. There is a question about exactly what was or what were these horses and chariots of fire. Here's a couple of options. John Gill says they were angels that looked like horses and chariots of fire. I have a problem with that. How can an angel look like a horse or a chariot? That's not what angels look like, unless you say they morphed themselves into a horse and a chariot, and I don't believe that. The other option, this is from Cambridge commentator Ellicott, the other option is to say that the horses and chariots of fire were visions, were part of a vision in the head of the attendant. Here's what Cambridge says, quote, "It is not necessary that we suppose the vision to have been of literal horses and chariots. The heavenly host was seen encamped about God's servant in such wise as to disperse all fear." Well, Cambridge says it's angels, kind of like Gill says, but it's only angels in the servant's head in a vision. It's not actually out there where you could see it. Now, that's not to say that the angels weren't actually out there where you couldn't see them. They're out there, but you just couldn't see them. But the servant did see it in his head. I think there's a lot of truth to that, except for the form. Angels usually don't look like horses and chariots. Here's what Ellicott says, quote, "The form of the supernatural appearance was, no doubt, conditioned by the circumstances of the time. Chariots and horses were the strength of the Aramean oppressors of Israel. Therefore, Jehovah, Yahweh, causes his earthly ministers to see that he also has at his command horses and chariots, and that of fire." In other words, the vision was matched to the situation. Horses and chariots for the bad guys. Well, God's got horses and chariots too. His horses and chariots of fire. He's got plenty of strength, and probably the strength was angels, but whatever. Whatever that strength was, it was a vision in the servant's head that he was seeing when he saw these chariots of horses and fire. But whatever it was, Elisha, we can say, had an amazing intercourse with heaven. He prays, and the heavenly vision opens up. Now the servant saw the horses of the fire, the horses and chariots of fire. He saw them all around Elisha in verse 17. That can mean one of two things. One, he saw the horses and chariots around Dothan, the city where Elijah was. Poole suggests that, and Poole also suggests option number two, that Elijah was in the center of the vision, so that the servant saw Elijah standing there surrounded by chariots of fire and horses of fire. I don't think so. It just seems more natural to me that he saw Dothan surrounded by these fiery chariots and horses, so therefore he knew that Elisha was protected. We go now to 2 Kings 6, verses 18 through 20. When they came down to him, that's the Syrian soldiers, when they came down to him, Elisha came down to Elisha. Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people with blindness, I pray." So he, that's Yahweh, struck the Syrian soldiers with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Then Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." The man whom they seek, of course, was Elisha. They didn't realize that Elisha was talking to them. And Elisha brought the Syrian soldiers to Samaria. When they had come into Samaria, Samaria remembers about, 10-15 miles southwest of Dothan, in the middle of Ephraim. Dothan is in Manasseh. When they had come into Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of these men, that they may see." So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. Verse 18 says, the soldiers came down to Elisha. What does that mean, coming down? Here's what John Gill says, quote, from the hill on which they were first seen, who came down from thence to the bottom of the hill on which the city stood, and whither Elisha, and whither Elisha came out, in order both to meet them and proceed on his journey to Samaria. In other words, the Syrians were on a hilltop. Dothan was on a hilltop. The soldiers came down. Elijah came down to meet them at the bottom in the valley there between the two hills. When he got down there, or right before that, Elisha prays to Yahweh and says, strike these soldiers with blindness, I pray. Now, does that mean complete blindness? I don't think so. Neither does Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who say this, quote, not in such manner that they could discern no object, for then they could not have followed Elisha. But their sight was so altered that they knew not the objects they saw. They appeared quite otherwise to them than they were. They saw the city, but knew it not to be the same. And Elisha, they saw Elisha, but knew him not to be the man of God, though they might have some in the host that knew him personally. In other words, their blindness was a blindness of confusion. They couldn't see properly. It doesn't mean they were totally stone blind. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that their blindness was a, quote, mental hallucination. They were confused. They weren't seeing what they thought they were seeing. So Elisha tells them, you're looking for this Elisha? Well, this is not the way into Dothan. That's not where you're going to find him. You're going to find him down in Samaria, which is a different way. I'll lead you there. Now, of course, going to Samaria was exactly where Elijah wanted them to go, because he knew that Joram would have troops down there that could capture these Syrians and put an end to this unfortunate affair. Now, was Elijah lying? Oh, yes, he was. He said, this is not the way. Well, you could say he wasn't lying. You can make a technical defense of Elijah, because it was truthful to say that the way to Dothan was not the way to Elijah, because Elijah's not in Dothan anymore. He's headed to Samaria. So when Elijah says, follow me and I will bring you to the man you seek, and so the Syrian soldiers follow Elijah, yes, they're being brought to Elisha, the man they seek. So you could say, see, he wasn't lying, but that's just a technical defense. He was deceiving, and a deception is a lie. We're not going to split hairs over that. He was lying. But as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, a subterfuge in war, etc., is perfectly legal. Of course it's legal. Of course it's moral. I love it how people say, well, God is not a God that he should lie. Well, that's true, but God is not having to fight wars or having to avoid crooks. So in verse 20, the Lord opened the eyes of the Syrian soldiers, and they saw that they were in the midst of Samaria. And they might have thought to themselves, hey, I thought we were outside of Dothan where Elisha was, and now we're in Samaria. How did that happen? Well, Elisha had probably sent his servant on before him to tell Joram, hey, I'm bringing some soldiers in, Sergeant York style. I'm bringing some soldiers in, so how about get ready to arrest them? And probably Joram did that. We go now to 2 Kings 6, verses 21 through 23. Then the king of Israel, that's Joram, when he saw them, saw the soldiers, said to Elisha, my father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? Elisha answered, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. So he, that's Joram, the king, prepared a great feast for these Syrian soldiers, and after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away, and they returned to their master, Ben-Hadad II, the king of Aram. So the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. Now notice in verse 21 that Joram calls Elisha, my father. He speaks with great reverence to Elisha. John Gill says he does that, although at other times he neglected and despised Elisha. He asked Elisha twice, shall I kill him? Shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? Notice the repetition. It shows his great desire to kill the Syrians. But Elisha immediately says, no, you're not going to kill them. It's against the common law of morality to kill POWs. Back then they sold them into slavery. They didn't have POW camps, but they certainly didn't kill POWs. It's interesting that the king of Israel was thinking about doing it anyway. He's not a great guy. He's Joram. He's an idolater. What do you expect? It sure would have reflected poorly on God for one of Yahweh's prophets to supernaturally catch the POWs and then have them murdered, it would have looked terrible. So instead of killing them, Elisha says, prepare a great feast for them. Set bread and water before them. That's the NASB translation. So apparently if that translation is accurate, then what we have is Elisha saying, they're tired, they're thirsty, they just walked all the way from Syria to Dothan to Samaria. They're hungry and thirsty, so give them some bread and water. And after you do that, prepare a great feast for them, and then they can really eat good. But the Holman Christian Study Bible translation says set food and water, because sometimes bread can stand for food. And therefore, the food and the water might therefore be the great feast that's being talked about here. It doesn't matter either way. The soldiers end up with a great feast instead of being killed. Why did Elisha give the soldiers, or tell Joram to give the soldiers, a great feast? Well, it was in order to show mercy. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, it would redound to the credit of the true religion, which inspired such an excellent spirit into its professors. And it would not only prevent the future opposition of the Syrians, but make them stand in awe of a people who, they had seen, were so remarkably protected by a prophet of Yahweh. The latter clause of 2 Kings 6:23 shows that these salutary effects were fully realized. That latter clause is this: so the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. A moral conquest had been gained over the Syrians. I think that's probably true. The Syrians saw the power of God, and they could have gotten killed, but they weren't, and so they said, yeah, maybe we better lay off the Israelites. However, we will see here in just a few verses that a short time later, a large army of Syrians did come against the Israelites in a hostile manner. So this raiding activity stopped for a while. My commentators say a year. I don't know where they get a year from. It doesn't say that anywhere. So they got peace for a while, but then Aram came back after Israel again. So we read in 2 Kings 6, verses 24 through 25. Sometime later, and again, the commentators say a year. I don't know how they know that. Sometime later, King Ben-Hadad, who's King Ben-Hadad II, who ruled from 860 to 841, King Ben-Hadad of Aram brought all his military units together and marched up to besiege Samaria. So there was a great famine in Samaria, and they continued the siege against it until a donkey's head sold for 80 silver shekels and a cup of dove's dung sold for 5 silver shekels. Now, this is Ben-Hadad again, Ben-Hadad II. His troops had just gotten captured by Elisha in Samaria as he led them from Dothan to Samaria, and here he is again. So he wasn't softened by Elisha's humane treatment of a year earlier, assuming it was a year. He besieges Samaria. Why Samaria? Well, that's the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. It's right in the middle of Ephraim. Joram had his palace there, his royal palace. There was a famine in Samaria. Apparently, the city had not taken the trouble to lay up stores against a siege, and so they were sort of defenseless. Apparently, maybe. But at any rate, things started getting tight in Samaria. A donkey's head, which, I don't know, that doesn't sound very tasteful to me, very appetizing. A donkey's head sold for 80 silver shekels. The NIV footnote says that's about 2 pounds of silver. 2 pounds of silver for a lousy donkey's head. A cup of dove's dung was sold for 5 silver shekels. The word cup is cab in the Hebrew. The NASB translates it as cab, K-A-B. The Holman Christian Study Bible has it as a cup. Apparently, nobody really knows what this is because the NIV footnote says that it was about a half pint of dove's dung, whereas the NASB note says it was approximately 2 quarts of dove's dung. Well, I don't care whether it was a half pint or 4 pints of dove's dung. Dove's dung ain't worth a pile of doodly squat. I mean, that's because that's what it is. And yet people were paying 2 ounces of silver for it. Things were tight. A donkey's head, of course, is not only unappetizing, it's probably not very meaty either. It wasn't clean legally either, of course, according to the Levitical law, but starving people aren't going to pay attention to the law, of course. Donkey's head would not have much flesh to eat, and what meat there would be to eat would probably be disagreeable. Now, as far as the either half pint or 2 quarts of dove's dung, why would anybody want to buy dove's dung? Here's 5 options. People wanted to use it for fuel, which was scarce, so they could burn it to cook something. Maybe for salt. I don't know how dove's dung has salt in it. Option number 2 is for salt. Option number 3, they wanted dove's dung for fertilizer. fertilizer. Dove's dung is noted in the East for being used as fertilizer for making cucumbers and melons. I don't know. I don't think they probably had too much time to think about growing crops when they're starving to death. Fourth option, they wanted dove's dung for food so they could eat it. Oh, gosh. Option number five, they wanted dove's dung so they could find the undigested grain within the dove's dung and then pick the grain out of the dung and eat the grain. Well, that seems pretty bad. That shows how extreme the famine was, and we'll see here in just a minute. They were engaged in cannibalism, too. So, yeah, they were in bad shape. I wouldn't be surprised if they had dove's dung so they could pick the grain out of it. Some say that dove's dung is not translated properly, that dung is not what the word means. Rather, it's a kind of pulse. Dove's dung is a kind of pulse, which is kind of a vegetable. It looks like chickpeas, as Adam Clark says. He says most learned men are of this opinion. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that, too. Well, none of the translations don't say that. But actually, that makes a little more sense, that people would buy a little bit of chickpeas for 2 ounces of silver. Dove's dung? Why would you buy dove's dung? Now, this siege of Samaria is the predicted accomplishment of the result of Ahab's foolish and misplaced kindness. Remember, Ahab is Joram's father. And Ahab, after getting beaten twice by the Syrians, by Ben-Hadad II, he finally beats Ben-Hadad II at the Battle of Aphek. After the battle, he shows mercy to Ben-Hadad II and wants to let him go. And an unnamed prophet came up to Ahab in 1 Kings 20, verse 42, and says this, "Thus says the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I had devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life and your people for his people." Well, Ben-Hadad II, instead of being killed, his troops killed Ahab when a stray arrow went through the joint in Ahab's armor at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead. So that came to pass. If Ahab had killed Ben-Hadad II, perhaps the Syrians wouldn't have attacked him. And also, says this unnamed prophet, your people shall go for his people. In other words, the Israelites are going to be sacrificed to the Syrians. And that's what's happening here in this famine. So we go now to verses 26 through 31. As the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, "Help, my lord, O king." He said, "If the Lord does not help you, from where shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the winepress?" And the king, this is Joram, said to her, "What is the matter with you?" And she answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, 'Give your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." I guess the moral of that story is, if you're going to make a pact to eat your kids, let the other person go first. Verse 30, when the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body. Then he, that's Joram, said, "May God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today." Verse 26, Joram's on the wall. Why? He was spying out the enemy, the Syrians. He was inspecting the troops. A woman sees him, says, "Help me." And he says, "Help you from what? The threshing floor? There's nothing on the threshing floor. There's no grain. How can I help you from that? From the wine press? There's no grapes in the wine press. I can't give you wine either. I can't help you. We don't have any food or wine." Now the question arises is, why did Joram even ask the woman, what's going on with you? What's the matter? What's your problem? Why would he ask that? It seems like it would be obvious that you needed food. Everybody else needed food. But maybe Joram pitied her because he thought that her distress was particularly pressing because she had reached out to the king. Now, this other woman who made the pact to eat the child of each, she fulfilled the curses that were put on Israel if the law was not obeyed. Deuteronomy 28:53. "Then you shall eat the offspring." Remember, these are the curses that were pronounced by the Levites from Mount Ebal, right north of Shechem. Shechem's in the valley between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And the curses were pronounced from Mount Ebal. So this is resounding across the valley, and all the people listened and said, "Amen." And this is what they were told. "Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you, during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you." Perfect fulfillment. Now here's a macabre question. Were the kids dead or alive when they were eaten? Did they take their kids and then just kill them and then eat them? Adam Clark says this, for the sake of humanity, we must allow that the children died through hunger and then became food for their starved, desperate parents. We hope the parents didn't kill their own children. That really would be bad. But given the state of human nature, it wouldn't surprise me that they did that, but hopefully they didn't. The king was horror-struck when he heard that, Joram was. So he tore his clothes. The typical sign of grief is when you tear your clothes. And when he tore his clothes, he had another typical sign of grief. On his person, his sackcloth that he was wearing under his clothes, the people saw it and they said, oh boy, the king is miserable. Now, Joram's response to this horrible situation, his horrible response to the report of cannibalism is, I'm going to go get Elisha. And he says this, may God do to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today. Now, what that oath meant was, if my head stays on my body, Elisha's head is going to be gone. But if Elisha's head stays on his body, then my head will be gone. May God do to me and more also. In other words, may he take my head off if I don't get Elisha's head off. In other words, I'm going to go kill Elisha. Now, why would Joram blame Elisha for the famine? John Gill speculates it's because Elisha had predicted the famine. Gill and Clark speculate that it's because Elijah had not prayed for the removal of the famine. John Gill further speculates that perhaps Elisha had told Joram to hold out. Don't give in to Ben-Hadad II. And by not giving in, the famine had spread to the point of cannibalism, and so Joram is angry about it. We go down to 2 Kings 6, verses 32 through 33, and we will finish this audio. Elisha was sitting in his house, this is in Samaria, and the elders were sitting with him. I'm sure they were hungry, unless Elijah had supernaturally provided food. He's done that before. Remember he took 20 barley loaves and fed it to 100 sons of the prophets in chapter 4? Doesn't say, but he's sitting in his house and the elders were with him. This, of course, is a rented house. Elisha did not own his own house. The elders were with him. Which elders? Elisha's disciples, perhaps, but I think it's most probably Joram's officials who had converted to Yahweh. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown holds to this. They say, quote, though Joram was a wicked king and most of his courtiers would resemble their master, many had been won over through the prophet's influence to the true religion. A meeting, probably a prayer meeting of those, was held in the house where Elisha lodged. That's another interesting detail, speculation. They were probably praying because everybody was starving to death. Before the messenger got to the house, Elisha said to the elders, don't you see how this murderer has sent someone to cut off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door to keep him out. Isn't the sound of his master's feet behind him? Joram's feet, in other words, is following his messenger. While Elisha was still speaking with them, the messenger came down to Elisha. Then Elisha said, we'll talk about that in a minute. Then he said, this disaster is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Now in verse 32, Elisha tells the elders sitting with him, hey, there's a messenger coming because that murderer Joram has sent somebody to cut off my head. That had to be a supernatural prophecy because who else would have told him that? Notice that Elisha commits a little bit of lèse majesté here. This murderer, he called the king of Israel a murderer. Well, he was a murderer because he wants to kill Elisha. These prophets are a little bit cranky. So Elisha takes a natural precaution, shut the door, don't let the messenger in, and don't let Joram in who's coming behind. Apparently, Elisha changes his mind because in verse 33, while Elisha was still speaking with him, the messenger came down to him. Now, he might have been speaking through the door. Now we need to ask the question, why would Joram follow the messenger on down to Elisha's house? Well, maybe Joram wanted to listen and hear what Elisha would say as Elisha talked to the messenger. He wanted to hear what Elisha would say when the messenger says, Joram's going to execute you. Joram might be a little bit nervous about that. Maybe Joram had changed his mind after he sent the messenger. He says, oh, I don't want to kill Elisha. That would be terrible. God might get me for that. And so he's running down there to stop the execution of Elisha. I really don't think that's true. That's Josephus's idea. Adam Clark says that it's a simple matter of this. Joram wanted to run down to Elisha to see Elisha's head cut off when he was arrested. Now, verse 33, we read this. Then he said, I said that he is ambiguous. Somebody said, this disaster is from the Lord. Well, who was it? Somebody said, "This disaster is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" Who said that? Well, here's three options. One, the messenger, speaking in Joram's name, says, "This disaster is from the Lord. Why shall I wait for the Lord any longer?" Well, to try to analyze it that way is the same as analyzing it if Joram actually shows up at the house and he's speaking. So let's forget the messenger right here. Let's say it's Joram himself personally speaking, not the messenger. Why would Joram say this disaster is from the Lord? Well, he's in despair, and he thinks that Yahweh is determined to ruin his people. So that's why he says this disaster is from the Lord. But then why would he say this? Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Well, you have to speculate that Elisha had told Joram earlier, wait, 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 don't surrender during this siege. The Lord will deliver you. And then Joram is saying, no, he's not going to deliver me. He's brought this disaster on Samaria. He's going to destroy the city. He's going to destroy it in me. What's the point of waiting for God's deliverance anymore? Well, that's reasonable, but I really think it's option number three that Elisha says this. Elisha said, this disaster is from the Lord. So he's telling the messenger this. This disaster is from the Lord. In other words, it's not from me. So why does your master, King Joram, want to punish me? I didn't do it. Go talk to God about it. Why don't you go punish him? I didn't have a thing to do with it. And then Elisha says, why should I wait for the Lord any longer? In other words, why do I need to wait for deliverance from Yahweh any more? Because deliverance is coming very soon. We'll read about that deliverance in the next chapter. So in the next chapter, we will see God deliver the northern Israelites in Samaria from this horrible famine. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.